to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at News Talk Radio. Today is Wednesday, January 5th, 2011. Happy New Year. 2011. How'd that happen? I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and as always, Writers on Writing focuses on authors, agents, and poets, and the books they create and sell. Today we have two guests. For the first half hour, I'll be here talking with T. Jefferson Parker. And during the second half, Marie Stone will be here. She's actually here now, but she will be conducting an interview with Joan Shankar. So stay with us for what should prove to be an hour of interesting talk. T. Jefferson Parker has been on the show before and is one of my favorite suspense writers. He was born in Los Angeles and has lived all of his life in Southern California. Took a bachelor's degree in English from UC Irvine, where I sit, and was honored in 1992 as a distinguished alumnus. He has many novels, 17, 18, so many, and they all deal with crime, life, and death in Southern California. He is so well reviewed and appears on so many bestseller lists. And he's here today to talk about The Border Lords, published by Dutton on January 11th, coming up pretty soon, but readable right now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you again.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Let's talk about Border Lords. We see Charlie Hood again, who is who we've met through previous novels, and he is pursuing a missing renegade undercover cop who has done some things that are questionable. Will you talk about that? Talk about how this story came about and perhaps proceeded from your last book?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Good synopsis. Sean Osborne is the undercover ATF man who is in tight with the powerful North Baja cartel. and he's been undercover with them for some months, and he apparently has cracked because he goes on a murderous and mysterious mission, and then he gets into his beautiful little Piper cub that he's owned for most of his adult life, Betty, and flies her south into Mexico and vanishes. And the story then is that of Charlie Hood, who's dispatched to go find Sean, stop him, and bring him back. And they're not only ATF counterparts and partners, but they become friends over the years. So it's a story about a friend tracking down another friend apparently gone very wrong. Real loosely, the story is a retelling of one of my favorite stories in novel form, anyway, which was Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, in which one character who is at the beginning kind of idealistic and very very driven to accomplish something good goes upriver metaphorically and literally the Congo in the case of Conrad, and there he loses himself, and the powers that he finds himself up against are so strong that they actually turn him into the opposite of what everything he intended to be. So this is that story of this man gone upriver, Sean Osborne, and then the more earnest investigator dispatched to bring him back.
That's interesting. Heart of Darkness. I remember loving that novel when I read it.
It's something, isn't it?
It's really something. And it stayed with me. And I'm curious about that, about, thinking of that novel in terms of your own. I mean, so when you went to approach this novel, were you thinking of that and how can I deal with that sort of, theme in my own way, or did you start writing this book and think this is like that?
it was more the former. I had my characters in place. Charlie working along the border as this ATF agent trying to staunch the flow of illegal weapons to Mexico, and I had his friend Sean with similar job, and I wanted to write about the loss of ideals and the loss of faith and the idea that sometimes everything a hero can bring to the table maybe isn't enough. And as I started the story, I thought, oh, you know what this is? This is the Heart of Darkness. I've been carrying that story of Kurtz and Marlowe around in my head, of course, ever since I read it back in college at UCI. And suddenly my head is one giant clip file for stuff. And suddenly the light went on, and I thought, okay, you've been looking for 25 years for a way to tell that story in your own words, if you will, or find a circumstance that will allow that story to be told again. And the light went on, and I thought, aha, that's it. So this book didn't really start that way, but I saw quickly that what I was kind of secretly doing, unknown to myself, was arranging the pieces of the story so that I could get to that sort of journey once again and in my own words.
Interesting. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here this morning with T. Jefferson Parker. His new novel is The Border Lords, published by Dutton. We've discussed this before, but perhaps for listeners who are listening for the first time and listening to us talk for the first time, this will all be new for them. But I think it's interesting anyway, just no matter how many times anyone's heard us talk about it. And that is how where you live influences what you write. When you were a resident of Orange County, a lot of your stuff took place in Laguna, Newport, here and there. And now you're in San Diego County, closer to the border. How does being down there influence your current sort of subject matter?
It changes everything. That's a good question. When I lived in Orange County, which I did up until 10 years ago, all my books were set there, and my history was there, if you will. My world was there, and in Orange County, I found endless things to write about. Never a dearth of material. But I left there for reasons other than that. Wanted a little more room. Wanted to get away from the kind of the crowds and the hecticness of Orange County. So we came down here to Fallbrook, which is very quiet. North San Diego County, but another 60 miles closer to the border. And Just a few years ago, I wrote a couple of books set in San Diego when I first moved down here, the city of San Diego, which I like. I like cities a lot, and I really like San Diego as a city. And then I kind of looked around me 4 or 5 years ago, about the time that, you know, Mexican President Calderon declared his war on drugs down in Mexico and started throwing money and troops and federal police at the drug cartels. About that time, 2006, those actions and the reactions that happened, the terrible violence, that backlash that happened when the war on drugs began down there was huge news here in San Diego County. Figuratively, I can look over my back fence and see the border practically. It's less than an hour's drive away. We hear about it a lot in the news down here. That whole world of Mexico opened up to me once I'd moved down here, simply because I felt closer to it physically, and it's the buzz was in the air. People were talking about it more. It affects you more. Here in Fallbrook, we're just a few miles north of the border, and that border between San Diego and Texas, along the Mexican nation, there is called the Iron River by some journalists and some law enforcement people. Iron meaning guns and river meaning flow, and so that's the area through which guns go south from the United States. And I became intrigued with that, and that kind of opened up the door for me writing about the cartel wars.
Well, I recall with The Renegades. The Renegades, I think that was the novel that sort of began all that, wasn't it?
He was up in Adelanto in the Antelope Valley in that book, and then Iron River introduced Charlie to the world of the border and the ATF and the guns and the cartels.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When Iron River came out then, I remember it seemed right around then that it really started hitting the news in terms of the gun running and the this whole idea. And I found it really interesting because you had to have been working on that book and that idea way before it hit the news. I found that just so interesting how your novel came out at the time when it hit the news. It couldn't have been better.
Yeah, it was certainly timely, and it still is. You know, I just that now that 2010 is over, and the grim statistics are trickling in through the media from the Mexican government and from ours. 2010, turns out to be by far the most violent of the 4 years that have transpired down there since the war on drugs began, and so in a lot of ways, I think these novels, The Border Lords and Iron River, is even more topical or of interest right now. If you think that those topics are interesting to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sure do. And I'd love to hear you read. Will you read from The Border Lords?
Oh yeah, I'd be happy to. I got a section here that takes place about maybe a third of the way through the book, and as you told your listeners, Charlie Hood is in pursuit of Sean Osborne, who has gone upriver, if you will, in his Piper Cub, and he's doing these mysterious things along the border. And Charlie learns that through a video that he sees that Sean has visited a curandera, a folk doctor, witch doctor, along the border in a little Mexican town, and Sean has gone there to ask this woman to show him a certain place. And Charlie doesn't know what the place is, but he thinks that it may be of import. So he goes down to the same village a few days after Osborne has been there, and he tracks down this woman, and he's going to ask her to take him to the same place that Sean wanted to see. So I'm going to read a few pages from that scene. Charlie's in Agua Blanca by afternoon. That's just a few miles below Tecate, and he's got directions on how to find the curandera's house. And he decides to stop and get a gift before he goes to find her.
Okay.
Hood stopped at the ice cream stand and got two deluxe popsicles, one coconut and one orange. He turned right and crunched down the wide dirt road. Half a mile later, he saw the hubcap with the spray of plastic flowers, long blanched of color by the sun. The driveway was not quite wide enough for his Durango, so the manzanita branches streaked its flanks. The house was a pale green cinder block rectangle with a water tank on the roof. She stood in the doorway as if she had been expecting him. He climbed down from the vehicle with the drink bottles in one hand and the popsicles in the other, and swung the door shut with an elbow. They spoke in Spanish. "Good evening. I'm Deputy Hood." She peered at him, face darkly lined, eyes fierce but steady. She was short and wiry, and she wore a black dress to her ankles and red slip-on sneakers. She wore a scapular made of dried peyote buttons interspersed with plastic Telmex calling cards of action pictures of famous soccer stars on them. Hood held out the popsicles, and she took the orange one and a soda. He explained that he wanted to see what she had shown to Sean Osborne. She motioned him into her home. The floor was swept recently, broom marks on concrete, and there was a propane oven and a three-burner stove and a sink and a poured concrete counter. She opened her bottle and handed the opener to Hood. "He is a white devil. He's a sick man. I want you to take me where you took him." "It is 10 minutes to drive." It was a 30-minute drive. The dirt road that wound up past the Curandera's house soon narrowed to a twist of ruts. Hood straddled them in the big SUV. The sun was lowering now, and there was a pink tint to the mesquite and madrone backlit by the sun. They cast blue shadows on the tan desert sand. The Curandera threw her popsicle stick and wrapper out the window, and a minute later, the soda can. Finally, the road ended in a fan of uphill paths that looked more traveled by flash floods than by humans or animals. The Curandera put her hand on the door pull, and Hood parked and shut off the engine. He came around to her side, and she started up a trail through the dry brown brush. Hood got his Glock from the toolbox in the back and clipped the holster to his belt, then locked up the vehicle and caught up with her. She led the way, walking briskly. Lizards hugged the rocks for the last warmth of sunlight. They climbed for a few minutes, then walked downhill into a stand of scrub oak and greasewood. Hood smelled the spring and saw the foundation of a small house that had been destroyed, now just a black smudge upon the earth. There was a rock chimney. Beyond the foundation, scattered sticks and rusted swatches of chicken wire lay half buried in the sand. She led him past the house and coop and a well and along a copse of greasewood trees. The ground around them was piled high with dead needles into which spiders had tunneled. Their webs caught the sunlight, and just inside the mouths of the tunnels, the spiders waited, pale and still. In the middle of a clearing was a rude rock pyramid, 4 feet high, made of desert stones held together with cement. It looked to have been hastily made, thick seams of cement and an erratic shape. There were 2 staunch iron rings set into the concrete, one low and one high. A length of heavy chain ran from each ring to the ground and ended in a manacle drilled for a lock. Hood looked down at one, the large, rusted iron bracelet, an exaggerated and seemingly ancient version of modern-day handcuffs. There was another pile of stones 30 feet away, at the edge of the greasewoods, and these were piled loose and dusted with dead brown needles. "Juan Batista lived here," she said. "Crazy. Eyes like the devil. Eyes like Sean Osborne. That is how I know." The Curandera walked to the manacles and placed the longer one over her small hand. Her dark fist moved easily in and out, so she raised it, and the huge rusted cuff slid to the crook of her elbow. The short lower manacle she placed around her ankle, and over each one she made a locking motion with an invisible key. Then she threw the key into the greasewood and sat down in the dirt and looked at Hood. He locked himself up and threw away the key? Yes, 7 days in the sun and he died. Many weeks later they pulled his hand and foot from the manacles and buried him where those stones are. Why did he do this? He lived with his young wife and gathered firewood. He got a fever. He began to tremble and scream. He panted, but he could not drink. He drooled all down his shirt and pants. He growled like a wolf. He became strong as a chupacabra. He bit and raped his wife for 4 days. He repented and locked himself here to die, to save her life. What made him go crazy? He was not crazy. He went with the devil. Was he an evil man? No, he always loved God. If he loved God, why did he go to the devil? The devil came to him. How? In the caves of his blood. I don't understand. You cannot understand. You cannot see. You cannot hear. This is his power over us. But when he comes into you, when it happens, then it cannot be hidden. All see and all know. This is our power over him. This is why he leaves us so quickly. She squinted at Hood. The sun was low in her face, burnishing it copper around the sharp teeth and the wise but feral eyes. When did you know that Sean had the devil inside him? the smell, the eyes. He would not look at his own reflection. He would not drink water. He wanted to see this place. These are signs. Hood looked at the crude stanchion, then at the loose pile of stones that marked Juan Bautista's grave. The sky was orange and black now in the west, and Hood felt suddenly alone and afraid. Like Oz must feel, he thought. He felt uncertain, too, as he knew Sean must. And Hood also felt compelled to finish his mission and find his friend, just as Osborne, he thought, must feel the need to complete his journey of murder and attempted miracle that he had begun and conceived in this dry place.
Thank you so much. That was T. Jefferson Parker reading from The Border Lords, published by Dutton on January 11th, in just a few days. One thing you do so well that you consistently do well from book to book is write setting and landscape, and it always adds to your story. Will you talk a little bit about this? We have a few minutes left, and I wonder if you could just, you know, enlighten our listeners a bit on landscape and setting and why that's so important and how to think of it, how to get at it.
You know, that's a good and interesting point. I've always liked setting as a reader. You know, I insist on I prefer a clear, definitive, interesting footing, you know, geographically and civically, where I am when I'm reading a novel. And so for myself, you know, Orange County was that for a while, and now Mexico and the desert is that. I think at the bottom of it all is it's a visual thing, and it's nice to see things through the page. You know, as a reader, you want to see things, and hopefully, if that scene is written correctly, you know, you can see the curandera with her black dress and her red slip-ons, and you can see the, you know, the glow of the setting sun coming through the, you know, the branches of the manzanita, etc., and it makes the scene come alive. I found myself the more I write, the older I get, the more time I seem to spend outside, and I write more outside scenes now than I ever used to. Most of the big scenes in my last two or three books are all outdoor scenes, so I'm becoming sort of a landscape painter, and I'm not really sure why, except that I love being outside, and I love hiking, and I love looking at things, and whether it's a forest or a mountain or a downtown Manhattan, it doesn't really matter, you know. It's just it's there, and it's a landscape, and I love being in it, and I love to try to bring especially kind of unusual landscapes to the reader, you know, like this little border town that I've created, mm-hmm. Buena Vista, for these books. And in the book I'm working on, in this book, Charlie goes down to Costa Rica into the jungle. And so I like kind of going to exotic places and reporting back. I maybe it's the old reporter kicking in, you know.
Well, I sure love reading it. And you know, we've only touched on this book, and we have more to talk about, which we will be doing on January 18th, mm-hmm. Tuesday. You'll be down here, up here, for the Pen on Fire Writers Salon. And so I very much look forward to seeing you then and talking more.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
That was T. Jefferson Parker. His new book is The Border Lords. And as I said, he will be with us on January 18th, which is a little more than a week away, here in Corona Del Mar. You can go to penonfire.com, click on Speaker Series on that file, and you will read about that event, and you can sign up there if you'd like to attend. The seating is limited, so if you're interested, please sign up sooner than later. That's it for now for me, and we're going to take a break, and then Marie will be back with Joan Shankar, and it's a biography on Patricia Highsmith that Joan has written, and it makes a perfect complement, I think, to this first half with Jeff. So stay with us for the next half hour, and we'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
me. Heard you're getting married, baby. Too bad it ain't to me. You found a man to do everything you say now. I guess that's the way you wanted it to be.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes under Talk News, or you can always visit Barbara's website at penonfire.com for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. As Barbara mentioned, we have a great speaker series event coming up on January 18th. Jeff Parker, who you just listened to, will be joining us for that, and he's always fun to have. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and Barbara and I are now joined by Joan Shankar. Joan has been called America's most original female contemporary playwright. Truly Wild, her biography of Oscar's interesting niece, Dolly Wilde, was hailed as a revelation, a great story of a life and of the creation of modern culture. The Talented Miss Highsmith has already been acclaimed as a definitive Highsmith biography. The Talented Mrs. Highsmith was published by St. Martin's Press in December of 2009. It was a finalist for the Edgar Allan Poe Award, the Agatha Award, the Anthony Award, and the Publishing Triangle Award in May of last year. The Talented Miss Highsmith received a 2010 Lambda Literary Award on December 8th. Norton published it. The Patricia Highsmith selected novels and short stories edited with an introduction by Joan. The collection is receiving rave reviews and is in bookstores now. And just yesterday, Picador released the paperback edition of The Talented Miss Highsmith. It's my pleasure to welcome Joan this morning. Thanks so much for joining me. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm delighted.
I think it's much warmer where you are.
Not by much these days. It's a bit chilly out there.
Well, global warming is going to freeze us all.
I think that's right. So I want to start by having you introduce Patricia Highsmith to us a little bit and tell us about how she inspired you to write about her.
Well, this is a long story, so I'll try to shorten it for you. Patricia Highsmith had a life unlike almost any other contemporary novelist. She left her country and actually didn't come back. She made her reputation in Europe, and because I, too, am a kind of expatriate, though I have the classic writer's apartment in Greenwich Village and live above a Greenwich Village literary cafe, probably the last one in the village, I too live in Europe, and I'm always looking for subjects that keep me there. I live in Paris. Highsmith spent 15 or 20 years in France, and somehow that seemed like a wonderful idea. Of course, I didn't know her. I didn't realize I was dealing with the most subversive imagination in the last half of the 20th century. So there were many shocks for me along the way, and I probably quit the book 100 times before I finished it, but I now find her. She and I have made a wonderful relationship, and we're quite matey now, and I find her still fascinating. You may not have heard the last of me on the subject of Patricia Highsmith. There's no American writer quite like her.
How did you originally come across her and become so captivated by her?
Something bubbled up out of my unconscious. I was speaking at a playwrights conference. We were in, I think, 1995. We were asked to memorialize writers who had died that year and asked to name them, and somehow the name Patricia Highsmith flew out of my mouth. I didn't even know I knew she was alive, much less dead. But there it was, and I thought, I better remember this. This is a little telegram from the unconscious, maybe giving me a new subject. So I did. And when I went to her archives in Bern, Switzerland, she was perverse enough to leave her 150 linear feet of written archives in the most expensive city in Europe, there in Switzerland, where I had to spend a good year and a half researching, watching my advance disappear and researching her with avid interest. And, you know, once I'd taken a look at those 38 writer's notebooks and 18 extraordinary diaries, I was hooked.
Mm-hmm. Another biography had come out about Patricia Highsmith, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago by Andrew Wilson. And,
yeah, not an accurate, yeah, or, if I may say ungraciously, an interesting enough book to have stopped me from
right.
writing.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that the book was in progress while I had started. I'd read a few things that he'd written and thought that I could do better.
And you had an amazing amount of access to an amazing amount of information. Was that, I assume that was sort of an unusual thing for you to be able to have?
It was, and I think it was because her trustees placed an enormous amount of confidence in me. They knew I wouldn't betray the material or sensationalize it in any way. She's sensational enough. There's no reason to add anything. There's something about the art of, the fine art, I should say, of biography that brings out the best and the worst in people. You can either act like the narrator of the Aspern papers, you know, be a publishing scoundrel and fossick around in people's private lives and do them damage, or you can, with a full and open heart, gain the confidence of people whose testimony you desperately need. I talked to more than 300 people for this book, and many of them I spoke with more than 10 times. So my own archives are now approaching the size of Highsmith, plus getting her trustees' permission to use all the material from those sulfurous diaries and really interesting notebooks. It's you have to be very careful. The writing of a biography creates an intolerable intimacy between the writer and her subject. You know more about this person than they know about themselves. You know more than their lovers knew. You know more. And you've got to be careful with the material. And I hope I always am.
Yeah. It's interesting that you raise that point, because I was curious about your connection to the subject. And, you know, we talk a lot about fiction on this show, and of course, you know, fictional characters are exactly that. They're fictional. But often writers talk about some sort of breath that they've kind of imbued into their mm-hmm. characters. And I'm wondering if you felt like there was something as a writer, as a biographer, that you needed to tap into your subject to write effectively about her. Did you feel like you needed to identify with her in some way to tap into that element that sort of, you know, makes her incredibly three-dimensional and human?
I could not have written this book in the way that I wrote it, which is in a rather experimental way, finding many different ways to enter her character. I couldn't have written it unless I felt every bit of it. I walked every place she went. I investigated every home she ever lived in or left emotional deposits in. I spoke to a million people, and quite disconcertingly, I found myself not only thinking some of her thoughts, but having some of her ideas. And since I'm a sort of a provisional member of at least four groups she spent the last half of her life reviling, it was pretty upsetting, which is part of her charm. She's completely transgressive.
Mm-hmm.
There is not one single feeling or idea I held that wasn't challenged and attacked by something in Highsmith's character or her work. And so in order to deal with it, I had to get quite a bit larger than I was, which is not such a bad thing for a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a workout. And because I find biography the most difficult art I've ever practiced. As you know, I'm a playwright and I've written short stories. A walk on the beach compared to this, because not only are you, as Virginia Woolf said, bound to the facts, and so the biographer's arm is always, you know, constricted in a way, you have to breathe into them imagination and metaphor and all the things that one uses in so-called creative writing, but you are responsible to an immutable set of facts, which you have to determine by, careful and historical means. So it's very interesting. It calls upon so many different disciplines and talents in a person as a writer that I'm, and also, you know, I'm irredeemably fascinated by human character. It was a natural move as someone who was a playwright to move into this business of biography.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about that. I'll remind my listeners that I'm speaking with Joan Shankar this morning, the author of The Talented Miss Highsmith, and you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM. I am so fascinated by this process of biography and being limited to the facts. One thing that Pat Highsmith had said at one point was about lying about the facts to tell the truth, and I'm captivated kind of by that notion of getting to the deeper truths, not by sticking to factual information, but by, I don't know.
Well, look, lies, if you want to put it in quotation, i.e. fiction, always light the way to truth. When I was writing plays, I read, because each of my plays is set in a different era and uses a different vernacular, I read a lot of biographies, I read a lot of history. Now that I'm writing biographies, I read a lot of novels for inspiration. And certainly the techniques that I used in The Talented Miss Highsmith are both come from experimental theater and from fiction writing, which is to say that once you've established the facts, and facts themselves, of course, are shifty little things, there are a million ways you can access human character. I did it in many ways. I made, halfway through the book, I made a very interesting list of all the things that were in her archives, so that by then you were sufficiently acquainted with her character so that the moment you saw an object, and she was a serious fetishist in both life and her fictions, the moment you saw an object on the list, you knew it began to resonate for you. I made a lot of maps, because Highsmith was a person who liked to locate herself in space. She had a real architect's imagination. And by making a map, for instance, of her life in Greenwich Village, which is where her imagination was really shaped, I was able to identify the fact that every single place in her novels where she killed a character was a place where she had made love with a lover in life. And that's something I could never have come to by simply going through the facts of her life. If I'd done a cradle-to-grave biography, I had to make a work that could reflect the imagination I was trying to historicize. So this book has a shape rather like Patricia Highsmith.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the structure of this book because
sure.
It is so wonderfully constructed. And tell me about, I assume that the bulk of the research, well, I shouldn't assume this. I'm wondering if the bulk of the research was done and then you looked across all of this for patterns, for emotional, as it's been called, her emotional watershed to create the structure.
When you're doing something like this, information never stops coming in. You never, what I did was what I do for my plays and stories too. I did the work, then did the research, which was intense and lasted for years and took me all around the world, and then I forgot it. and I began to write.
Mm-hmm.
And as I wrote, up it came, but in a different form, transformed. I was able to find metaphors that expressed her. It's very important to me to start with a metaphorical base that will express her and take you to a place other than mere journalistic biography. Biographers are supposed to be artists on oath. Too often they're journalists on deadline.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
This had to be an equal, a work that was as artistic as the work that she did in order to express her. And I hope that I've done that.
Yeah, the stunning part of this biography is that it does both. So it follows sort of this emotional imagination metaphor, as you've so beautifully talked about and is so beautifully written, and then it has, you know, 150 pages of notes and appendices and
almost killed me. and there's also I did because some people need chronology to stabilize themselves. There's a 30 pages of it's the first too, a strict chronological. It's called I forget what I called it, Patricia Highsmith, Cradle to Grave, I think. It's a strict chronological notation of her life, so you can use that to cross reference. How and when things happened to her and in what order. The organization principle I had in my mind, and I knew I wanted it from the beginning, was to organize the book according to her obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
She was driven as a writer by her. Those were her motor. And once you identify a creative person's motoring machine, that's what you really have to start with. So I did organize it loosely according to her obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to work. It really, as Henry James would have said, rotated her aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that I don't feel she'd be displeased with it. And that's saying a lot, since she was displeased with everything.
Yeah. I also want to give you a chance to read from this, because the prose, unlike Patricia Highsmith's prose, which is cut to the bone, this is so beautiful, metaphoric. I wonder also if you're, maybe you can talk about this a moment before you do your reading, if you're, how your playwriting has informed either your writing style or your ability to tap into character.
Well, I still, every sentence I write, I still pronounce aloud,
mm-hmm.
as I spent the first part of my writing life writing for the human voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly has made it very important for me to give a voice to everyone I'm writing about. And one of the great pleasures of this book were the thousands of really interesting, well, not thousands, I'm exaggerating, dozens of interesting men and women who wouldn't have been notated except that I found them, and they had interesting things to say about Patricia Highsmith, and so they all have a voice in this book, too. They're like a Greek chorus standing,
right.
And I quote them at great length, because when people speak well, I think their voices should ring in a book.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of different voices.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to read you a very nicely written passage about Patricia Highsmith at 52 years old, already quite disillusioned, sitting in her house in Moncourt, France, making two lists. One was called Little Crimes for Little Tots, in which she made a careful list of seven ways children could murder their parents. Another was a little list she made of how she could murder children. She figured, well, a child from 2 to 8 would take one blow to the head. She was a richly comic character, really. But since I think this book is, this our conversation is going to be broadcast near or on her 90th birthday,
mm-hmm.
which is January 19th. It's also Edgar Allan Poe's birthday. I think it might be his 167th. And she was very delighted to be born on Poe's birthday. That was really interesting. I thought I'd read something a little more inspirational. It's very, very short, but it does have to do with New Year's. And one more explanation. I set up the book with a opening chapter and a closing chapter with Highsmith at her desk. Because the first thing everyone says about writers is how uninteresting they are. All they do is sit at their desks. Well, people should only know what happens to us at our desks. And I tried to make it clear. So I can do this. This is a very short little reading, but it I think it will give you both my voice and Highsmith's voice.
Perfect. Perfect.
When Pat Highsmith was 26 years old and still alight with 100 new ideas a day, still attracting lovers like a magnet, still writing for the comics, still having the time of her life in a Manhattan where the American dream was still vibrantly alive, she picked up her pen in the early hours of the last day of December 1947 and condensed her hopes for the coming year into a single sentence. She called this little challenge, for that's what it was, a youthful fist raised in the face of fortune, my New Year's toast. She could as easily have called it my epitaph. Quote, 2:30 a.m., my New Year's toast. To all the devils, lusts, passions, greeds, envies, loves, hates, strange desires, enemies ghostly and real, the army of memories with which I do battle, may they never give me peace. End quote. They never did.
Is that how you came away from the book after having written it and spent so much time with her?
I came away feeling that she really contributed something extraordinary to the. She added a new terror to the world. She did something that no one else did, and yes, that is that. That's among other things. This book is the resolution of my argument with Patricia Highsmith, and I think when you're in an intimate and such a lengthy relationship, the book took 8 years, and actually that was rather speedy for the amount of material I had to metabolize and change, transform into something, you know, a history, albeit a very unconventional one. It's always, any book is always a record of the writer's argument with her subject.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter what you're writing, a novel, there's always something in it. And the you could say that the irritation I felt with her was exactly the grain of sand that this oyster needed. She pushed me to some of my best work, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we may not be finished.
I hope
There's
not.
There's more to go. And we were very pleased to see that the book was one of the New York Times' 100 notable books at the end of this year.
As well it should have been. I mean, it's really a stunning achievement. Yeah, it's really a stunning achievement. Do you have any last-minute words of advice for either biographers or writers in general?
Well, advice is always pernicious, but there is one thing I would say, because I have to remind myself of it all the time. Habit is much more important in writing than inspiration. If you sit down at the same place, the same time, every day, prepare a seat for the muse, not always expecting her, but hoping she'll arrive, something will happen.
Mm-hmm. I love it. And a great piece of wisdom and advice for the new year as people are making their resolutions and hoping to sit down every day at their chair for a little while. That's wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Joan, this was wonderful. I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much. That was Joan Shankar, The Talented Miss Highsmith, The Secret Life and Serious Art of Patricia Highsmith is the book. It came out in paperback yesterday by Picador. It is absolutely a fascinating, wonderful read. Patricia Highsmith is, as Joan so eloquently pointed out time and again, she will challenge